Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers available at carthage.edu/admission/transfer. Support for WGTD also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's program, we're going to be playing an interview out of the archives that has to do with Vince Lombardi and the Green Bay Packers. And we're doing so because this weekend is the second of 3 weekends of performances at the Racine Theater Guild of Eric Simonson's marvelous play, Lombardi. So this is an interview from several years ago with the author of a fascinating book about Lombardi and the Packers at the beginning. For the next few minutes here on WGTD's Morning Show, we are taking a look at a very crucial season in the history of the Green Bay Packers. And I think whether or not you are a fan of the Packers, and really whether or not you're even a fan of football, I think there is very good potential for you to enjoy a book which actually is going to be of great interest to any Packer fan. It's a book called That First Season, How Vince Lombardi Took the Worst Team in the NFL and Set It on the Path to Glory. This is a book about effecting one of the most dramatic turnarounds in NFL history, because the Packers, when Vince Lombardi took them over, was the worst team in the football league, and there was every indication that they were going to remain on that path of despair for some time to come. Vince Lombardi comes to Green Bay, and the effect, although not quite immediate and by no means painless, was really quite dramatic, extraordinary, actually. But it's so interesting to look at this moment when that turnaround first begins. The author of this book is John Eisenberg, who is an award-winning sports columnist at the Baltimore Sun, and he has a number of different books to his credit, some of which have involved the world of horse racing. And again, this book is called That First Season. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. John Eisenberg, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
One of the things I most love about your book is just the very concept of it. That is that I think if you put a bunch of people in a room and tried to come up with ideas for great books, most of us would think of things like the first time the Green Bay Packers won the Super Bowl, or the first time the Pittsburgh Steelers won the Super Bowl, or those kind of moments of where greatness is first achieved. This book is really not quite about that. It's about something a little bit different and in many respects far more interesting. Talk about that distinction.
Well, thank you. Well, where the idea came from pretty much was, I'm a sports writer by trade and have been for many years. I'm a sports historian. I'm a fan. And like anyone who follows football a little bit, I knew all about the Lombardi Packers and knew about the championship games that they won and the Super Bowls and the great games, the Ice Bowl. I've seen the films, read the books, and I thought, wow, you know, those are all great. Enjoyed them very much, but I was doing some research, and I happened to come across some statistics pointing to the state of the Packers before he got there, and I was just astounded at sort of the low ebb that they were, where they were at that time. That the year before he got there, they won just one game, and that 3 years before he got there, they were still playing at East High School, their season ticket base, they probably had 10 or 11,000 paying customers. But yet on that team that won one game in 1958 was Bart Starr, Jim Taylor, Paul Hornung, Ray Nitschke, Jim Ringo, Jerry Kramer, 7 future Hall of Famers.
So it's not like they were a bunch of nobodies with no talent.
No. So I thought, well, I think people know those stories of the great games, but I think there was an untold portion of the Lombardi dynasty. If I didn't know about it, I thought, well, I hoped that other people didn't know about it. And the turnaround story at the beginning of his era, I thought was something new and fresh, at least from a historical perspective. So I embarked on the process. And
of course, you're doing so in this 50th anniversary year. That is the 50th anniversary of Vince Lombardi, beginning with the Packers.
Right, right. And that was by design. You know, that's the book publishing industry. It was, 50 years ago. And so it was targeted for that.
Hmm. And fortunately, as we certainly learn in reading your books, and more specifically in the acknowledgments, although many of the key players, literally and otherwise, are no longer with us, there are many of them who still are, and you were able to talk with them, and that is what gives this book such a sense of immediacy, that you are not just looking at newspaper clippings and so on, but actually talk to some of the Packers on the field, on the sidelines, who were part of this momentous turnaround season.
Yes, I did. I went around the country interviewing them, and I considered it a privilege. It was fun. Who wouldn't to sit down with Bart Starr and to sit down with Jim Taylor and Paul Hornung and a lot of the linemen from that era, maybe not quite as well-known, Bob Skowronski, Norm Masters, Bobby Dillon is still the career interceptions leader for the Packers, played in the 50s. So, yes, I interviewed all of them, and I knew I had a good book on my hands. I know they'd been asked a lot of questions about Lombardi over the years, and they love talking about him. But I knew I had a fresh question on my hands. You know, I would say, do you remember the first time that you met Lombardi? And there would be this long pause. They all had the same response, this long pause, and then they would start smiling to themselves, and then they would chuckle, and then they would say, oh, yeah. I remember the first time I met Lombardi, and there was always, then they would impart a story in which he had, you know, something he had yelled at them. Now, this is like the first time he'd yelled at them or set the law down on some rule that they were going to be had to adhere to from now on. And so he was tough on them from the very beginning, and they remember the early time vividly.
Right. Well, particularly because it was such a drastic change from the very loose sort of operation which had been in place before, which is one of the reasons they had fallen on such hard times. I mean, this was a new era in almost every sense of the word, and of course people would have pretty vivid memories of their first run-in with that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Scooter McLean, the coach that was there the year before him, with a 1-1 game, he was had been an assistant for 7 years, and he was sort of the good cop on the staff, you know, the assistant coach. He would play poker with the guys after curfew, and they all took his money. They loved Scooter, and he would, if practice would go, he would make them run wind sprints at the end of practice. They'd say, oh, Scooter, come on, these are hard. We got a game coming up. He'd say, oh, you're right, fellas, let's stop. And so there was almost no discipline at all, none. And I think that you could see the effects of that on the field. And Lombardi came in, and suddenly there were all these rules and just an incredible amount of discipline. I mean, if you weren't on in bed with lights out at 11, you were fined. If you were caught standing at a bar, you were fined. Just standing at the bar.
Even drinking ginger ale, he said.
Even drinking ginger ale. So numerous, and that doesn't even, I'm not even going into, the training camp was just grueling and rigorous. They were going to be in physical shape. So just a number of ways he changed the entire culture immediately from the day he got to town.
We're speaking with John Eisenberg. We're talking about his book, That First Season, How Vince Lombardi Took the Worst Team in the NFL and Set It on the Path to Glory. This is not primarily what your book is about, but I hope you won't mind if we just spend a minute or two talking about the early history of the Packers. I'm so glad that you include some of this here, again, because I meant sincerely what I said earlier, that I don't think you have to be a fan of the Packers or even a fan of football to necessarily find this book really, really interesting, because it's this human story of turning something around. But it really helps to understand what Vince Lombardi did if we have a little bit of history about this particular team, the Green Bay Packers, and in particular, what set them apart even 50 years ago from the typical NFL team. Talk a moment about this sort of small city, big city divide between the Packers and most of their competitors in the NFL.
Well, certainly the Packers were dated back to the origins of pro football, right after World War One, when pro football started up. It was kind of like pro wrestling. Not nearly as popular, but it wasn't considered a serious sport in many respects by most people. College football was much more popular, and pro football sprung up in a lot of Midwestern industrial towns, smaller towns. It wasn't a big city venture at all, and so there were these sort of scrappy teams. The Packers were one of them that played before a few thousand fans. It was not a big deal. The Packers had one of the better histories in that era. They started winning championships in the late 20s and through the 30s, and it started to grow, obviously, and cities started to have teams in New York and Chicago. And the Packers continued to do fairly well through that era, but once all the small-town teams sort of died out, every one of them except the Packers, who managed to continue to exist, and pro football became a big-city venture, the New York Giants, Chicago Bears, and then teams in Cleveland, Los Angeles, Washington, and the Packers, suddenly there was a disparity after World War II. When the sport began to take off, and these other teams were playing in large stadiums in big cities, L.A. Coliseum, there's 100,000 people there, and the Packers were at East High School with 15,000, and they were lucky, and they started to lose. They didn't have as much money. There was no revenue sharing in the league, and they had very little once TV came in, a small TV contract. So they were at a competitive disadvantage. And they lost throughout the 1950s, lost badly year after year. And there was some talk that they might have to leave Green Bay because the people in the league just couldn't see them getting out of this tailspin. It was hard to imagine with they had a great history, but nothing else going for them as these other teams moved ahead. So really, Lombardi came to town at a crucial juncture in the history of the franchise. And it's not a huge stretch to say that he may well have saved the franchise.
Hmm. You point out a couple of things which made these rotten years even more rotten, even harder for the players to live through. One of them, you talk about how the citizens of Green Bay really loved this dynamic of their hometown team taking on rivals from these huge American cities. I mean, it made them even more anxious for their beloved Packers to win. And there were points at times when that happened, but that stopped happening at some point, of course, which was really painful. You point out something else that I thought was fascinating, and that is that there were plenty of retired Packers from the glory years who had married local women and settled there right in Green Bay. You tell us the police chief played on the 1919 team. The fire chief had played with the great Johnny Blood. 24 former players lived nearby and attended games. Reminders of better times were everywhere. I think that's probably an often overlooked component in how the downturn of the Packers was especially painful for those players experiencing it directly.
Without a doubt. It's not like today when these players jump from city to city and they live in Florida in the off season or California or Texas, somewhere where the weather's warm. These were residents and this was a time when football players were not wealthy men. They were working class people like everybody else, and they had jobs while they played during the off season. They had careers after they finished playing, and they were just part of the community. They weren't really any different than anyone else. But in Green Bay, especially as the present became more and more sort of depressing, I guess would be the word. They really clung to the past, and they treasured the past. The Packers did have a great history, and it made the people of Green Bay incredibly proud to know that the big Chicago Bears came to town. You know, there was a period of time when the Bears came to town, and the team from Green Bay whipped them, and the people of Green Bay just treasured that. That was really all they had because the team in its current state was not good. So they loved their history.
One issue besides the sort of lax culture, which you've already mentioned, is the fact that the Green Bay Packers organization was set up in rather laborious fashion. Tell us the way in which this team was managed and the way in which that really had to be drastically overhauled before this team was going to be able to function a bit better.
Yes, well, of course, as your listeners know, they're owned then as now by the community, people that own shares in the team, a publicly held company, and that public, those shareholders would vote in a board of directors, about 45 people back then. The board of directors would vote on and elect an executive committee that ran the team. The executive committee back in the era just before Lombardi was 13 people. It was a large group, and they ran the team. Once Curly Lambeau, of course, was the famous figure who got the Packers started and was their figurehead, their main guy for 30 years, and he got crossways with them after a while, largely over money, and quit in the late 40s. Throughout the 50s, the executive committee really ran the team in a very heavy-handed style. Once Curly, the major figure, was out of the way, they had a committee for everything, a committee for game programs, a committee for contracts, a committee for coaching, and all this stuff. So it was really a team run by committees. And like a lot of any business run by committee, most people will tell you, it wasn't too effective. There was a lot of bumping into each other and a lot of butting into the affairs of the on-field product, which was self-defeating. And every Monday after a game, the coach had to put on his coat and trundle over to the Northland Hotel. You know, he'd been watching film, and sit down with the executive committee and just take their questions, a lot of which, it was a grilling. They would be grilled on Mondays. And so, it was not easy to be the coach. It was not wasn't a streamlined, effective organization. But all that had changed by the time Lombardi got there. A lot of people think, well, Lombardi came in and changed that. The reality is, in 1958, as they were watching this unfold, the people running it said, this is not working. And so we need to streamline this. And they had voted to change from 13 people to 7 on the executive committee and to also let football people run the team. They did that before Lombardi came in there. It so happened that Lombardi stepped into that situation. Very fortunate for him. But it is true that the executive committee had decided before that to sort of change the way they did business.
Right. You cite team president Dominic Olenzak as one of the people who realized that the Packers needed to function differently if they were ever going to taste the success they'd had before. Your book actually begins with what in many respects is the lowest point of this low period, a 56-0 thrashing. I can't remember now at the hands of what team.
Baltimore Colts.
Ah. And you tell us that the day after that loss, the coach, Scooter McLean, as was usually the case, was watching films of the game, and you said, the films were a horror show. Sitting in a dark room as the projector whirred, Scooter saw that, as he suspected, some players had simply quit.
Yep.
So that was what we were talking about. I mean, a team that was lacked discipline to that extent that they not only in many respects lacked the ability or physical wherewithal to get the job done, but their heart just simply wasn't in it. I mean, in a way that's probably, relatively unthinkable in professional sports.
Well, I had to be very careful when I wrote that passage for obvious reasons. No player 50 years hence or whatever wants to be known as someone who quit in a game. So I ran this by a lot of people before I wrote that. And, some people didn't want to name names. Yes, there was definitely during that game in the second half, raining, they were in Baltimore just getting massacred by Johnny Unitas, and there were some people that just sort of bagged it. It was actually Art Daly in the Green Bay Press Gazette wrote that the next day, that it was the biggest quit, quotes in quotes, the biggest quit in Packer history.
Wow. And ultimately this season ends 1-10-1, the worst season record in Packers history. Obviously, a change needs to occur at the top once the sort of the organizational structure of the team has been changed. And ultimately, the man brought in is Vince Lombardi, who learned the business of football and sort of forged his own coaching style from a couple of different teams and with a couple of different people with which he'd worked. Tell us what was most important about Vince Lombardi's experience in football before coming to the Packers. What shaped him?
Well, he had been a high school coach in New Jersey and then 5 years at Army under Red Blake, who was a legendary coach back then, and then 5 years as the offensive assistant for the New York Giants. And I think if I had to say which of those informed his style the most, it would be the 5 years with Red Blake. Red Blake was really Lombardi's mentor in football. And Red Blake, he coached at the Service Academy, and a lot of those teams, you know, as you might imagine, his style made the most of what you could get at a Service Academy, which was a lot of discipline, a lot of organization, an emphasis on fundamentals, nothing really fancy, great effort, you know, simple, straight-ahead football, executed well, and executed and practiced until it was executed well. So Lombardi was really, really affected by that, and when he came to the Giants, he put a lot of that in motion as an offensive assistant. A lot of those pros didn't like it. You know, they weren't getting paid enough money to get yelled at is what they thought. And but ultimately became a very, very effective style with the Giants. And he put his own things. He tweaked to Red Blake's system. He was an offensive innovator, an X's and O's guy, and he had some fun blending the pass with the run and trick plays like the halfback pass and things like that. And so when he got to Green Bay, he had 5 years in the pros sort of as an assistant, tweaking a system that had really sprang, it really came from his time at Army. And then he added to the final piece of the puzzle was his ability to lead, which I think was sort of intrinsic. You know, that was his personality. And once he had a team under his thumb, once he had his own team, then that's when his powers of leadership sort of came to the fore. And those, I think, were just a natural. That's who he was.
You tell us that as he was interviewed by Dominic Olenzak and the others at the top of the organization, you say his interviewers found it slightly unsettling that he, meaning Lombardi, had never been a college or pro head coach. And Lombardi insisted that he would only come to Green Bay as a dual coach general manager with full control of the team. I mean, really, when you think about it, given the kind of experience that he had, Lombardi was asking for a lot. And it was a real, I suppose, step of faith and act of courage for them to give someone like Lombardi that amount of control, especially given the way in which the Packers had typically been operating and run.
Yeah, I think he sort of put in a big city power play there. I think he just kind of came in and said, hey, I'm a New York guy. I'm the big guy. I've been with the Giants. I've been at Army. And his voice filled a room, and he commanded the room, and it wasn't fake. It's who he was. But I think Wellington Mara, who owned the Giants, was one of the lions of the NFL, told him he had been offered the job to coach the Eagles the year before and turned it down. Wellington Mara said, "Don't go there because they have meddling owners, and you won't get what you want to do." And so he turned it down, got a raise from Mara. And then this time in Green Bay, Mara said, "Well, you can go, but make sure that you're unimpeded as a coach." And he asked for a lot of things, and it was just a good timing. The Packers were ready to cede control to a guy, and they finally decided this was the guy. Certainly, one of the better moves they ever made.
Of course, but you know, at the moment, they could have no way of knowing with any certainty that it was the move that was going to make the big difference. But You tell us Lombardi was thinking to himself, if this is my only shot, I'm going to do things my way. You tell us, one of the things I really appreciate about your book as we enter Chapter 5 is that as you describe the scene of Vince Lombardi first coming to Green Bay as the newly hired coach, you paint a picture of of Olenzak and the other directors waiting there with not much in the way of nervousness. They're shivering and smiling. You say few had seen Lombardi in person. They showed no sign of nervous anticipation as he walked down the portable stairway. Lombardi was not a legend. Grown men didn't gape when he walked by. He was just a football coach, a career assistant, until now. I mean, it's so important for us to be reminded about this because, of course, now he is the great Vince Lombardi. He practically belongs on Mount Rushmore, but not back in 1959, not yet.
That was my goal in this book, to be very honest with you. My goal in writing this book, once I sat down to do it, was to paint him in human terms. Because if I'm going to write a narrative of the 1959 season, it begins, as it begins, Lombardi is no one's idea of a legend. He's just a coach that has his own set of insecurities. He's a little old and for a head coach, and he wants his first and only shot. He wants to do well. And no, he is not a legend. He is an unknown guy for the most part in Green Bay. And I thought it was important to depict that and to relate that and to make sure people understood that he was a human, and he made mistakes that first year too. Like, you know, he might belong on the side of Mount Rushmore now, but he did make mistakes. He was a human being.
Tell us about a couple of the things he did, not even yet with the players, but just with, for instance, those managers of the team. There are a couple of moments you tell us about in which Lombardi very emphatically established his undeniable authority. I mean, that he was altogether another step up from those directors, and he made that unmistakably clear right from the start.
Well, I think what you're referring to, right, that period, when he first came to Green Bay that day, that very day, there was a radio man that wanted to interview him as he got off the plane, and Dominic Olenichuk and the directors were there to greet him and said, "Oh, we'll do that tomorrow. There's a press conference." And Lombardi said, "No, I'm doing it now.
I promised him an interview, and I'm giving him an interview."
Right, and of course, Scooter would have said, "Oh, well, whatever they want, they get." But Lombardi, I thought that was a little moment that spoke volumes.
Absolutely.
Like, from now on, I'm doing what I want. And that's pretty much the case.
Wasn't there also a moment when he essentially turned Olenzak and others away from training camp? I mean, they had expected to kind of show up and hang around. And didn't he sort of eject them? Or maybe it was from a players meeting or something.
Well, at the very beginning of training camp, he's doing a meeting. He's running a meeting, and he looks out, and he sees Dominic in the back of the room, man that had hired him. And he says, "What are you doing here?" And, you know, he shrinks out. This is the head of the executive committee, shrinks out of the back of the room. And Lombardi tells him later, "Look, you know, I'm sorry, but this is I'm the coach, and this is not for ownership. And, you know, we can do our thing in the offices, but the coach of the team, this is for coaches and players." And they let him do it. I mean, they so it was very clear, you know, he had Wellington Mara's words in his ears, you know, you do what you want.
One of the things that he began talking about, which apparently connected very powerfully with especially some of the Packers, was when he began using terms like perfection and described himself to his staff as a perfectionist. And this was the kind of language that apparently the Packers had not really heard from any of their coaches in quite some time, if ever. And you know, now we read those words, and that doesn't seem like that big a deal for a coach to be a perfectionist or to have his players striving for perfection. But this in and of itself was really transformative for this team. Explain why.
Well, they had really, throughout pro football in the 50s, I mean, don't get me wrong, Paul Brown was a fantastic coach in Cleveland and an innovator and won championships and was very organized and disciplined and people, you know, did what he wanted but on his team. But a lot of the coaches, a lot of the teams, I mean, the best player was Bobby Lane of the Detroit Lions, who was, you know, out all night drinking, and he'd show up on Sunday and it was sort of a gunslinger. It was a more of a loose coalition of guys. You know, it wasn't so organized and crisp. And so, you know, the coaching wasn't really heavy-handed that way. More of that was, you'd see more of that in college ball.
Right. If so, I can read, I love the way you put this. You said hard-boiled college coaches such as Bear Bryant could get away with demanding that impressionable youngsters not make mistakes. But pro players were older, wilder, and harder to manage. Frankly, not paid enough to put up with such high-minded bull from their coaches. Lombardi might have a fight on his hands, the assistants feared, in terms of demanding and expecting perfection from his players.
Yeah, they weren't making enough money to have a guy make them do the same play 40 times in a row until they got it exactly right. So, yeah, there was a lot of concern about that among the staff, but Lombardi was undeterred.
Hmm.
We're going to do it.
Tell our listeners about some of the ways in which training camp was like nothing else that any of these Packers had ever experienced before.
Well, calisthenics went on for half an hour. There were people going to drop it and going to the hospital. He would have these things, these players still talk about it years later, called a grass drill, which was running in place, and he'd yell down. They'd have to hit the ground on their bellies, and then he'd say up. They'd jump back up and keep running in place. 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes. He was going to get them in shape. So tremendous amount of exercise, a lot of running, wind sprints. These guys that had not done any training suddenly were in shape. And they would have these one-on-one drills, a nutcracker it was called, where linemen would line up against each other. You know, it's like those National Geographic videos, you know, where you see the two animals out in the wild, you know, button heads. He would do that for hours on end. He was going to make them tough, and then they would practice these plays. He simplified the playbook a great deal, but he demanded that they run these few plays correctly. So practice, practice, practice.
I actually was just trying to find in the book the specific mathematics, because you tell us at one point just how simplified the playbook became. I mean, compared to what Coach Scooter had before, I mean, it was a much smaller playbook. And then, as you say, he wanted those many fewer plays done much more effectively.
Well, Scooter's playbook was 4 inches thick. It was a lot of gadget plays and arrows and do this and do that and options. It was indecipherable, I think, to most of the players. Jim Taylor couldn't remember the plays. He had to sit on the bench. And Lombardi came in, and it was maybe a quarter of an inch or a half an inch thick. Just, here's our playbook. It's simple. We're going to run a few variations off of them, maybe 40 plays max, as opposed to probably 200. And, you know, but we're going to emphasize these simple plays. It's basic stuff. The Packers, you know, end to sweep, off tackle, square out to the receivers, simple stuff. But we're going to, if you really execute well and know what you're doing, we will beat people with them.
One of his innovations with training camp was something that occurred regarding some of the veteran players. He started training camp with actually the rookies, and then the veterans were allowed to come a little bit later. Tell us about the very surprising experience of a couple of veterans who came on site a day or two early, thinking that they would be, I think, maybe playing some golf or something, as they had typically done in years past. Tell them what Lombardi made them do.
Right, that was Jerry Kramer and Joe Francis, I believe, drove in, and they were veterans. They were second-year players in 59. They'd seen the veterans the year before. You could show up a few days early to camp while the rookies practiced and play golf, sleep in, go out at night, have fun. So they showed up. They got ready to go play golf, and Lombardi was standing at the door saying, "Where are you going?" And they said, "Oh, we're going to play golf." He says, "Well, you better put those clubs away. Once you're in this building, once you're in camp, you're going to practice. There's none of that. The old rules don't exist anymore." And some of the veterans exploded, hated that. The young guys like Kramer and Francis just went there, put their uniforms on and went to practice. But some people didn't like it, but that's the way it was.
One of the biggest reasons why training camp was so important was because among Vince Lombardi's biggest concerns was that the Packers of the previous season were, at least for the most part, woefully out of shape. it's probably important for us to say that that this was an era when there were probably plenty of pro football players who were not in shape in the way we think of pro football players now, finely honed machines. But even by the standards of 50 years ago, the Packers were a very out-of-shape ball club.
Yeah, if they didn't do it on their own, it wasn't done, really. I mean, like I said earlier, the wind sprints at the end of practice were often called off. It was just sort of a little bit of exercise to get warmed up. They really didn't train. They just didn't. So and they smoked cigarettes. I mean, you go back and look, it was pretty sad. They were just not in playing shape at all. Hmm. So that was a huge change.
One of the things that Vince Lombardi had to figure out is what players were going to be able to figure in this new culture that he was trying to build, and those players that were gifted but also disciplined and committed enough to make things happen. And as we read your book, we realize that had to be one of the greatest challenges for Vince Lombardi. And I think it's especially striking that he ends up ultimately embracing players as different from one another as Paul Hornung and Bart Starr. I mean, you couldn't ask for two more disparate football players in terms of temperament and personality and personal priorities.
Oh, that is true. That was probably his greatest triumph, was looking at the films of that season the year before and the ashes of it and figuring out who could and couldn't play. I mean, we are at the crux of the matter of the turnaround there. It's deciding, well, which of these guys on this team can I go forward with and which can't I go forward with? And the great triumph of any leader is to put people in the positions where they can succeed as opposed to fail. And that was certainly the case with Hornung, who had been floundering as a pro, drafted as a quarterback. He was sitting on the bench. He was played fullback some. They didn't know what to do with him. But Lombardi said he'll be the halfback in my system, and he can run, catch, throw, pass, kick, do all these things. And so he found a place for him. And Starr took a long time. He was had been in the league 3 years and had not done well, and Lombardi wasn't sure that he was the guy, and as a matter of fact, picked some other people ahead of him. But in the long run, Starr proved to Lombardi that he was the quarterback for the future.
Hmm. You remind us, actually, that the NFL team where Lombardi was before the Packers, the New York Giants, had a really odd scenario at the quarterback position. And you tell us it's not clear just whose idea it was, but Lombardi was the offensive coordinator of the Giants, so it's possible he had something to do with the odd way they handled the quarterback situation for the Giants. Can you tell listeners about that? I was fascinated to read this.
Yes, well, Lombardi, I think it was probably Lombardi's doing. They had a couple of quarterbacks on the Giants, Don Heinrich and Charlie Connerly. Connerly was the main quarterback, but Lombardi would start Heinrich, who was kind of a sharp guy, and he would start Heinrich. Heinrich would play the first quarter, and Lombardi would stand on the sidelines with Connerly and say, "You can do this. Look what he's doing. You can do that. You can exploit this. You can exploit that." He would almost have a tutorial through the first quarter while Heinrich played. And then he would put Connerly in. I mean, today the coach would be fired in 2 minutes. It's like you're wasting the first quarter without your best quarterback there. What are you thinking? But Lombardi sort of thought it was important enough to that what he could explain to Connerly on the sidelines would be useful. So that's what they did, and they wound up in the championship game a lot. So it did work.
Yeah, it's just a fascinating scenario,
yeah.
And it comes to mind because among the most difficult choices Lombardi faced, as you've already said, is from an array of what at one point was six different quarterbacks. He had to figure out who exactly was going to start. And actually, even as the season gets underway, the position of quarterback is still far from settled.
Yes. No, that was very far from settled. He inherited... Lombardi inherited Babe Parilli and Bart Starr and Joe Francis as quarterbacks. They had been there in 58. Francis was a single wing in college quarterback, just a runner. Pirelli and Starr were veterans who had not done very well, and he didn't like any of them. So he traded for Lamar McCann, who was a veteran with the Chicago Cardinals, a losing team, but he was a good athlete, and he played well in a lot of games. And he traded for him to be the starter, and it was very unsettled. There were a lot of quarterbacks in camp, and he threw it open as a competition. But I think he thought all along that McCann was probably going to be the guy, and he leaned that way. And sure enough, McCann wound up starting the season as his quarterback.
Hmm. As the preseason begins, things are so much better than they had been the previous season. As the Packers go on kind of a barnstorming tour, things are looking better, although by no means perfect. You tell us after one of the first games, which they lost, Lombardi said, "We made an error on every play." And you can imagine how a perfectionist like Vince Lombardi probably would look at those game films and literally see an error of some sort from somebody on every single play. I mean, in some ways, that line, as much as any, indicates the change in attitude with the Green Bay Packers in the way they were being coached.
Yes, they definitely, it was a new day. And he had put in these few simple plays, and it took a long time for the players to sort of execute them by rote in a lot of ways. But the players knew when they heard something like that he was going to continue to push them. That's for sure.
Hmm. You tell us that when the team watched films before, it had been a very quiet thing where lots of players even fell asleep. Lombardi, conversely, was like a tuba player in a library. With his voice rising in anger, he pointed out mistakes, castigated the perpetrators, and frequently rewound film to show the offenses again. I mean, that really fills us with some admiration for those Packer veterans who had seen life in a very different way. I mean, for them to adapt to this new style, I mean, for most of them, it had to be a tremendous challenge, not so much for someone like Bart Starr, but for some of the other Packers so undisciplined. This was a whole new world.
Yes. They still talk about it 50 years later. Those film sessions, I think, if you asked some of them, what do you remember most about Lombardi, they'll tell you, "I remember those darn film sessions where you'd sit in there and he'd yell at you and you just heard that voice booming through the hall."
Well, and then pause the film. I mean, once he'd shown that dropped pass or that missed tackle, he'd stop the film, rewind it, show it again.
Look at it again, and he'd yell at him. And, oh, my gosh, just you can only imagine, you know, with that voice cascading through there. He was tough on him, that's for sure.
Hmm. One of the last things he did before the regular season started was persuade a veteran by the name of Bobby Dillon to come back to the Packers. He was not going to come back. I think he was. Was he going to retire?
Yes, he was going to retire go into business in Texas. As a matter of fact, he already had.
Hmm. He is persuaded to come out of retirement. And then tell our listeners what happened to Bobby Dillon. I mean, when he is told about some money he owes.
Well, Bobby, the Packers had problems in the secondary, and Lombardi said, "We really need to get him back." He had gone into business, and they persuaded him to come back finally. And he said, "Oh, okay, training camp had already started." And they told him, "Well, that's great that you're coming back, but now you're going to be fined for holding out." And Dillon, who's an extremely bright guy, wound up very successful in business, said, "The heck with that. You know, you can take that money and put it where the sun doesn't shine because, you know, I didn't hold out. I'd quit."
And you talked me into coming back. I mean,
right.
This wasn't even my idea. And
right.
Now you're going to fine me for missing training camp.
So he said, "Forget it." And Lombardi got on the horn and said, "Okay, we'll pay the fine. We have to keep up standards. This is something that we're doing with anyone who holds out, even if you don't think you did. We have to keep up appearances. I will pay the fine. But you're going to have to pretend that you were fined if you don't mind, because we have to keep up this appearances, and Dillon went for it. He couldn't quite believe this guy Didn't know where he's coming from, but he went along with it.
Hmm. Well, as did most of the Packers, and as this season gets underway then in part two of your book, we are taken through what amounts to an amazing season, but a tumultuous one, full of ups and downs. And it's really interesting because as you take us through training camp and the preseason, we really have sort of the same expectation as probably a lot of people did in Green Bay and some of the players, that that happy days are here again, and the season would be just one triumph after another. It actually is a much more complicated season than that.
Well, it is. They did start well. They had a good preseason, and they started well. They won their first three games. They were all at home, and it did appear that they were on their way. Lombardi had them going. They had beaten some good teams, the 49ers, the Detroit Lions, and it appeared that they were on their way. But then they did enter a losing streak. The Rams beat them at home, beat them in Milwaukee. The game was in Milwaukee. They beat them 45-6, and it was like everything came crashing down. They were still had to adjust to Lombardi's ways, and the quarterback situation in the long run was unsettled, and they didn't quite have it down yet. Their personnel was still adjusting. And they wound up in the longest losing streak of Lombardi's career with the Packers. It came in his first year. They lost five games in a row. And people were fans, I think. A lot of them, if you can believe this, 50 years later, a lot of them thought, well, this guy's just like Scooter. He's not much better. I mean, look, they're losing. So they lost. They went on the road and lost to everybody. And they were having a tough time. And a lot of people doubted Lombardi. But with the insertion of Starr at quarterback, and sort of the light bulb coming on, I think, for a lot of these guys on mastering the playbook, they finished the season on a big roll. And that's the most interesting part, I think, that by the end of the season, he had Starr at quarterback, he had Jim Taylor at fullback, he had Horning at halfback, he had Boyd Dowler split right, McGee split left. I mean, the outline of the team that would dominate football suddenly was there, and I think everybody could see, oh my gosh, something is about to happen here.
It's one of the reasons Lombardi decides to stay put, even though he is given a very, very tempting offer.
Well, he certainly is. After the Wellington Mara, who owned the Giants, loved Lombardi and wished that he could have hired Lombardi to coach the Giants. New York native, of course, Lombardi, and never lived anywhere else. So after the 59th season, the Lombardi is coach of the year. Jim Lee Howell, who had been the coach of the Giants through the 50s, says, I'm burned out. I want to retire. So the Wellington Mara called Lombardi and asked him to come back. Lombardi thought about it and said, well, I've just signed a five-year contract. I'm 1 year into it. I can't do that. I just can't do that as much as I'd like to. And so he stayed.
Hmm. And he one of the reasons for sure he stayed is he knew that amazing things were right around the corner for the Green Bay Packers, and of course, they were. The book is That First Season, How Vince Lombardi Took the Worst Team in the NFL and Set It on the Path to Glory. A fascinating book which takes us also step by step through this monumental first season and all kinds of amazing stories told by all kinds of players who were on hand for this important moment in Packers history. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin, the author, John Eisenberg. John Eisenberg, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. This was so much fun, and I so enjoyed your wonderful book.
Oh, well, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Monday on The Morning Show, we'll be having a candidates forum for the 21st Assembly District seat. Van Wongard and Lori Hawkins will be live in the studio. And on Tuesday, we'll be talking about a new production of the great classic Glass Menagerie, which is about to open in Kenosha, presented by a new theatrical company, the Fleeting Artists Theater. And on Wednesday, I look forward to sharing with you my interview with Reina Grande, author of a new memoir called A Dream Called Home. And a follow-up interview on Thursday will give her a chance.